We have to end that by changing this whole system, making the system work the way it's supposed to, which is it's supposed to protect all people.
6 weeks ago, 6 months ago, 6 years ago, it would have been inconceivable that that officer would have been charged.
Is what Tim Scott is offering in these proposals better than nothing, or are they enough to, you know, perhaps squander the momentum that you have right now in trying to get something bigger, more substantial passed through?
We're now seeing a disturbing surge of infections that looks like it's a combination, but one of the things is an increase in community spread, and that's something that I'm really quite concerned about.
From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and radio affiliates. I'm Scott Baba. In today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy, Hard Knock Radio heads to Oakland to report from the protests at the Port of Oakland and to discuss the importance of Juneteenth. San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin talks criminal justice reform. KPFA hosts talk about congressional action on police reform, and Dr. Anthony Fauci testifies before Congress about coronavirus. But first, the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News headlines. New coronavirus cases in the U.S. have surged to their highest level in 2 months and are now back to where they were at the height of the outbreak. The U.S. reported 34,700 new cases of the virus yesterday, according to a tally compiled by Johns Hopkins University. New cases in this country have been surging for more than a week after trending down for more than 6 weeks. Several states set single-day records, including California, Arizona, Mississippi, Nevada, and Texas. More than half the states are seeing a spike in cases. Because of that, U.S. citizens are unlikely to be allowed into Europe when the continent reopens its borders next week. The European Union wants to open up on July 1st. Member nations are debating exactly what criteria should apply when choosing who should be let in. One is the infection rate. The European Commission is recommending the EU not allow travel by visitors from countries where the COVID-19 situation is worse than the EU. That would rule out the U.S., also Brazil, India, and Russia. The historic South Carolina city of Charleston is removing a symbol of its legacy. City crews were at work early this morning to take down a statue honoring John C. Calhoun, an early U.S. vice president whose zealous defense of slavery led the nation towards civil war. The Charleston City Council and mayor voted unanimously last night to remove it. Councilman Carl Brady Jr. said he knew his support for removal could cost him politically, but that he would vote his conscience.
It was so that everyone who passed by would be forced to literally and figuratively look up to his memory of white supremacy. I want to implore my colleagues on council to vote with me on removing the statue of John C. Calhoun so that we can send a message that in a holy city, we place white supremacy and white supremacist thought back where it belongs, on the ash heap of history.
The vote came after public comment phoned into the virtual meeting. About 40% of enslaved Africans brought to North America came through the port city of Charleston, which formally apologized in 2018 for its role in the slave trade. Mourners paid their final respects to Rayshard Brooks at the Atlanta church where the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. used to preach. The Reverend Bernice King, the civil rights leader's daughter, told the Crown that the killing took place in Atlanta, the Black Mecca, in the city that is supposed to be too busy to hate. Brooks was shot in the back by a white police officer.
Rayshard Brooks's life matters, and he should have been able to live to enjoy his family and watch his kids grow up into adulthood. And the officers should have gone home that night without blood on their hands.
The Reverend Raphael Warnock, senior pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church, recited a long list of names of Black people who died at the hands of police in recent years, including Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Philando Castile, and George Floyd, and said, sadly, we've gotten too much practice at this. The nation's second largest school district has rejected a proposal to defund campus police. The board of the Los Angeles Unified School District voted against a measure that would have reduced the budget of the 460-officer LA Schools Police Department by 90% by 2024. Some board members said they were worried about maintaining student safety. The board heard nearly 12 hours of public comment. Most speakers called for reducing or eliminating the force. They said Black and other students of color are disproportionately singled out for arrest by campus police. The Board of United Teachers of Los Angeles, the teachers union, endorsed the call to defund the school police department and said $63 million of the $70 million policing budget should be used for counseling and other student services. In San Francisco, though, board members voted unanimously to remove San Francisco police from the city's schools. The resolution directs the superintendent to lead a process with parent and community input to revise the district's school safety plan. Funds would be reallocated to school-based social workers, psychologists, restorative justice practitioners, or other mental or behavioral health professionals. There may be another political upset in New York, where a progressive African-American educator, Jamal Bowman, was far ahead of 16-term incumbent Elliot Engel in a Democratic congressional primary. The latest tally showed Bowman with nearly 61% of the vote to Engel's nearly 36%. It's not clear how many vote-by-mail ballots remain to be counted. Bowman spoke at his campaign party last night.
Elliot Engel, and I'll say his name once, used to say that he was a thorn in the side of Donald Trump. But you know what Donald Trump is more afraid of than anything else? A Black man with power. That is what Donald Trump is afraid of.
Bowman has backing from New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who scored an upset victory of her own 2 years ago when she defeated 10-term incumbent Joe Crowley. Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren also backing Bowman. He's a longtime educator who grew up in public housing with a single mother. In Kentucky, first-term state legislator Charles Booker, who is African-American, was trailing former Marine fighter pilot Amy McGrath, who's white, for the Democratic Senate nomination from Kentucky. The winner will take on Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in the fall.
First up, Davey D is the co-host of Hard Knock Radio, a drive-time hip-hop talk show on KPFA. He went to the Port of Oakland, which was shut down by the local Longshoremen Union in observance of Juneteenth, a holiday celebrating the end of slavery in Texas on June 19, 1865, 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. There, he spoke with Trent Willis, president of ILWU Local 10, about Juneteenth and why it was still important today.
Trent, first of all, are you surprised at the large crowd that's out here today? And what's your main message to everybody?
Actually, we're not surprised at the crowd today. We're impressed, but not surprised. The time to end systemic racism and police terror in this country is way past due. The only thing the ILWU did was put the call out. We knew that the people would answer, and we are absolutely elated at the participation in this demonstration. We're not surprised, but we are very thankful.
When I went down to the port, there were thousands of cars. I couldn't even get up to the rally where you all were at, you know? And there's thousands of people here. And this is being replicated all around the country. What is it with the political leaders that they're not making the moves that you all are demanding? What is it that they don't get? How are they not seeing these thousands of people out on the streets making specific demands and it not immediately being, put into action on their behalf?
Well, the only thing I can say about those people, they are the unfortunate victims of the cracks in capitalism. Okay? Capitalism is an evil system. Okay? We all know that. The thing is depending on how it's used and how it's taken advantage of by the super rich and these big corporations and the 1%, really dictates how some people act. We can get into many discussions in that area. One in regards to business unionists. That's where you get your business unionists from. The beauty about events like this and the beauty about the young folks coming out in particular is that it's showing business unionists and it's showing elected representatives who sometimes are, most of the time, favor big business because of the money and the payoffs or whatever you want to call it. It shows them where the real power is. The power is in the people. It's in the people when they're united, black, white, red, and brown. And once that happens, it's really nothing that can be done. Okay, that's why you know, that's why you see them when we swell the ground up underneath them like we're doing now. They start to come to our side.
Last question. People are listening all over the country. What are the marching orders that you give them from a union perspective that is, you know, workable for everybody listening?
Well, I'm going to put it like this. In 1863, we had the Emancipation Proclamation. 2.5 years later, the slaves in Texas found out they were free when they were actually free 2 years prior. In our opinion, we are still not free. This is the significance of having this event on Juneteenth. Okay, we would like to make Juneteenth a national holiday. I'd be the first one to put out the call for that if somebody hasn't already done it already. We need to end slavery once and for all. Slavery did not end in 1865. It just changed colors. Okay, they changed the strategy. Okay, the police started out being slave catchers. Okay, that hasn't changed. Okay, all of the laws that we have that are detrimental to black and brown people give the police free rein at whatever they want to do to poor and black and brown people. We have to end that by changing this whole system, making the system work the way it's supposed to, which is it's supposed to protect all people, red, yellow, black, white, and brown. And until it is like that, we will continue to have demonstrations like this. We will continue to advocate for labor to get involved and to use the power of our labor to make change.
You were listening to Trent Willis, president of ILWU Local 10 Longshoremen Union, talking to Davey D. During the Juneteenth events, Davey D also spoke with rapper and activist Boots Riley about the mass protests happening across the country and ways to sustain the growing movement for black lives and state accountability.
Boots, man, first thing I want to ask is, how are you doing with this pandemic, and what are your thoughts on all the activities that have been going on with the fight for police accountability, justice for George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and so many others?
Well, it's very inspiring, the millions of people that have gone out into the streets in every city, every little town. You got little towns where it's population 10,000 and 2,000 people show up. You got, you got people doing stuff in solidarity, like right here, where they shut down the whole West Coast in solidarity. This morning, Tesla workers were going to walk out in support of Black Lives Matter and in solidarity with this action. And Elon Musk got scared and decided, oh, it's a holiday anyway. And so we see this big possibility for growth. The one thing that we need to give it is teeth. We need to give a way to exact a demand, right? And so that's where stopping production, that's where stopping profit comes in, and that's where this one day symbol of the way that we can do it is important.
Let me ask you this, and we're just talking with Boots Riley. If you're tuning in, we're down here at Oscar Grant Plaza or Franco Garza Plaza down here in downtown Oakland. Big, huge march. When I was down at the port, that's where it started at, there were thousands of cars. I mean, so there should be. Are you surprised that this many people have come out?
No, because people are looking for a way to fight. Everybody, while this has been happening, are like, okay, we got all these people in the streets tearing shit up. Where's our leverage point? And so people are inspired and excited by this idea that the leverage point is in the fact that we can shut down production. And so people are excited. They come out to support because they want to see it happen more.
The ultimate goal is to shut down production. But we also know that there are many other agendas. Some people want to completely abolish the system. Some people want to reform it.
Those aren't two different goals, I would say. The question, the shutting down production is how do you get to a goal? Shutting down production isn't the goal. Shutting down production is a strategy to where you can hold profit hostage and ransom the demands, right? So, that is the question. What are the winnable demands? And I don't think that has been figured out yet. And somebody has to, I'll say this. Abolishing the police has been put out there. But I think a lot of people have a lot of different ideas about how do you do that and when does it happen? Like, when does it happen? In the sense that, the reason the police are so brutal, the reason the police are murderous is because they are here to protect capital. It's because the reason that they're racist is because it's part of a whole system that protects economic exploitation. So that's the thing they're going to physically, militarily fight for. It's like that is their arm. That's their physical arm. So is that, my personal question is that possible before there's a revolution? And so anyway, that's something that's getting worked out in process.
Well, let me ask you this, Boots. A lot of people really came out in the streets after they saw George Floyd. So there's a good percentage of people that are really angry with the police. There are many unions where the rank and file, like today, are out, but the union heads have not necessarily signed on to defunding or abolishing the police. And what is that about? Some things I heard is that they are protective of the police unions. They don't want to get, can you explain that, reconcile why we haven't seen some of these big union heads denounce the police the way that their rank and file members that we see out here today have?
Well, let's say this. One victory is that in Seattle, the Labor Council booted the police union out. That just happened like yesterday, I think. And so there's some struggle going on around this. But unions aren't about the union heads. Unions are derive their power from the rank and file, the people that are actually at work that are able to be a threat to stopping work. So the union heads or whatever, often they're people that have a job and their career is that. So it doesn't matter whether they have the same politic as the rank and file or not. You see that as in when, even just in the election, when certain union heads were saying, no, vote for this person, and the rank and file was like, you, we're voting for this person, right? All of that, so that sort of politic, I don't even want to waste my time with that. The point is that the people are getting more radical. The people are seeing that there needs to be a fundamental change in the economy, and there needs to be a fundamental change in how we are oppressed during this time, meaning that needs to stop. And people are willing to do more for it. And so just like in other times in history, it's the rank and file that's going to push everything forward. And the movement that we need that stops production is not going to be just from these traditional unions. It's going to come from the 93% of the workforce that hasn't been unionized yet that starts shutting down. And that's happening in different places.
Let me ask you this. I know they're about to start the drumming, talking with Boots Riley, if you're just checking us out. What mistakes did we make in the past that we should avoid moving forward so that movements like this don't get compromised? What mistakes did we make in the past that we should avoid moving forward?
Oh, too many. But I think we can narrow it down to one thing is something that is being addressed today, is the fact that we got to look at where our power is. We can't just make a movement be about expressing outrage. It needs to express outrage, but it needs to do it with power. And the point is that our power comes from the fact that we are the ones that create the wealth. And we can collectively withhold that. And at that point, that's when we start recognizing what the contradictions are under this system. And that's when we start recognizing where our power is.
That was Davey D speaking to Boots Riley in Oakland on Juneteenth. Stay with us. We'll be back after this short break. Chesa Boudin was elected as San Francisco's district attorney last year after running on a platform of criminal justice system reform. Since being elected to office, he has pushed for significant changes to the criminal justice system, like eliminating cash bail and replacing it with a risk-based system in which prosecutors evaluate whether or not someone poses a threat to public safety as a condition for their pretrial release. He spoke to Dennis Bernstein, host of Pacifica Radio's Flashpoints. They spoke about criminal justice, how Boudin's personal experience as the son of incarcerated Weather Underground members Kathy Boudin and David Gilbert pushed him to pursue reform, and the way the ongoing protests against police violence are creating an opportunity for change.
I want to start off with Atlanta and the indictments, but let me just read a little bit off the wire so to bring people up to speed. A former Atlanta police officer was charged this afternoon with murder and aggravated assault in the fatal shooting of Rayshard Brooks outside a Wendy's fast food restaurant in Atlanta. The officer, Garrett Rolfe, faces 11 charges, with prosecutors saying that Rolfe shot Brooks twice in the back and then kicked him as he was lying on the ground. Mr. District Attorney, I'd love to get your response. These are pretty strong charges coming out of a DA's office against police.
They are, and I think it speaks to the moment, the really unique historic moment that we're in. It was a really tragic and unnecessary shooting. The video makes very clear that the officer shot multiple times at a person who was running away from him, had his back turned to him. And, you know, we have to really question, why would an officer use lethal force to try to stop an unarmed person running away from what had been a very calm and nonviolent, unarmed interaction around the possibility of driving under the influence? I mean, it's just tragic and it's unnecessary. But I think one of the things that's important to emphasize is 6 weeks ago, 6 months ago, 6 years ago, it would have been inconceivable that officer would have been charged. The political pressure, the grassroots social movement and uprising around this country that we have seen since the murder of George Floyd, attacking white supremacy, demanding transparency and accountability and creativity when it comes to how our neighborhoods and communities are policed, has also put tremendous and long overdue pressure on district attorneys like myself to enforce the law equally and to ensure that we are not turning a blind eye on crimes committed by law enforcement.
But this still will not be a cakewalk by any means.
No question. There are real challenges to successfully prosecuting police officers, no matter how egregious the circumstances of the crimes that they're accused of. It's hard to get juries to be willing to be open-minded to convicting police officers. That's one challenge. Another is, it's very hard to do a good investigation of a crime allegedly committed by a police officer or law enforcement, because the officers who are accused of these crimes are the ones on scene, and their partners and colleagues are the ones who respond after the shooting, and they're the ones who speak to witnesses and gather evidence. And it can be very, very challenging to do an independent investigation. Often witnesses disappear, video footage may disappear, or it may be impossible to track down. So that's another challenge, just the investigative side of it. And then a third challenge, and I won't speak to Georgia law on this, but a third challenge that I know is true in most parts of the country, and certainly in California, is that the law makes it very easy for officers to justify use of force, even in situations like this. There's a rule in many jurisdictions called the fleeing felon rule that basically allows police officers to legally, lawfully shoot, even shoot to kill, at a person fleeing them who they believe or have reason to believe committed a felony. And that's in my view, a really crazy law. We don't want police to shoot, kill people who are accused of felonies. There are so many thousands of felonies, and virtually none of them are eligible for the death penalty. In San Francisco, of course, we never seek the death penalty. Why would we want an officer to shoot to kill when the person hasn't even been formally charged or convicted? Now, obviously, there are some circumstances where someone is fleeing, they've kidnapped a person, there's a serious and clear risk of death or great bodily injury if the police allow the suspect to get away. That's a different situation, and it's certainly not the context in which Rashard Brooks was killed. And so I think it's time to reevaluate critically our laws, our policies, our allocation of resources, and our built-in systemic conflicts of interest so that we can really ensure the public trusts law enforcement and the public knows that the law will be applied equally.
Can I ask you to just respond a little bit to the killing of George Floyd? Clearly, the dam broke there. What were your thoughts on that as you saw that unfold? Were you surprised? Does that give you some hope in terms of perhaps we have a country ready for a real transformation? This is, I ask you this in the context of this is sort of your vision. This is a real opening for the way you consider law enforcement and the kinds of transformations you're thinking about. So I'm wondering about your thinking in that context.
Well, first of all, let me just say watching that video is heartbreaking. It's horrific. It's tragic. It's painful. It's nauseating. And in many ways, it's more violent and more intimately violent than even the shooting of Rashard Brooks or many of these other officer-involved shootings. There's something about the duration of the murder. You know, a gunshot is quick. A gunshot is from a distance. What we saw happen over nearly 9 minutes to Mr. Floyd was flesh on flesh. And it was an officer who knew that he was being videoed, who was watching the camera on him with indifference. That speaks both to the inhumanity of the act, but also to the confidence that he would be able to commit this murder with impunity. And but for the national uprising, he would have been right. But for the tremendous upswelling of energy from Black Lives Matter activists and from police reform activists and from the progressive prosecutor movement and from so many others saying enough is enough, he would have been right. He would have been correct that he could have literally gotten away with murder. And if you read the police report that was written by those officers before this national movement came to pass, it was the kind of police report that totally misrepresents the nature of the violent interaction between these law enforcement officers sworn to serve and protect their community and a man being investigated for a crime as simple as using a counterfeit $20 bill. So I look at that, and on the one hand, I'm heartbroken. On the other hand, I think it's absolutely cause for hope and for optimism because of the way that the country has responded, because of the way that it has created an opportunity for all of us to engage in a long overdue and much needed national conversation, critically examining our history of white supremacy, the ways in which racism is deeply embedded in many, many institutions, every government, every area of government, housing, education, public health, employment, and of course, criminal justice, and the ways in which it's put the spotlight on an issue that, as you know, I've worked on for much of my life and was a centerpiece of my campaign to be San Francisco District Attorney last year, which is how we can hold police accountable, how we can ensure that the folks we trust with the power to wear a uniform and carry a gun and to make arrests on our streets are held to the highest standards and serve with the most pristine levels of integrity and restraint. That's certainly not what's happening in most parts of the country today, and we need to move in that direction quickly.
Maybe we can backtrack. Can I? I'd like to invite you to share a little bit about your own remarkable story of your upbringing and your life before you came became a district attorney. I don't just mean being a translator for Hugo Chavez, but I would like you to talk a little bit about sort of from where you came and remind people, because there are a lot of young people listening to this that don't know the history, an incredibly important background that you have.
Well, I was born in 1980, and at the time, my parents were living in New York City. They'd moved there; they moved back east from California. And my parents were very active during the 1960s and 70s in Students for a Democratic Society, in the Weather Underground, a wide range of groups that were involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement and the civil rights movement. And that work led my biological parents to want to play a supportive role for a group called the Black Liberation Army, split off of the Black Panther Party, a militant Black liberation group, Black nationalist group. And on October 20th, 1981, my parents dropped me off at the babysitter in Manhattan, and they headed off for the day, told the babysitter they'd pick me up that night. What happened next is that my parents drove a getaway car that was used to help people who had just committed an armed robbery of a Brinks truck to get away. The armed robbery went wrong. A security guard was shot and killed. Another security guard was seriously injured. And then my parents' vehicle was stopped at a roadblock, and my parents came out of the car unarmed with their hands up. The officers went around to the back of the truck to search the back of the truck my parents were driving. And the people who had committed the robbery came out shooting assault rifles and killed two police officers. Both of my parents were arrested that day. My mother ended up serving 22 years in prison. My father was sentenced to a 75-year minimum sentence and is still incarcerated today. He may never get out. As a result of what my parents did and what happened to them and what they participated in, my earliest memories are going through steel gates and metal detectors just to visit them, just to give them a hug. My experience my whole life has been intimately connected with America's system of mass incarceration. And I noticed from a very early age the racial disparities in who was incarcerated. I noticed the ways in which our criminal justice system, tremendously expensive and resource intensive, fails systematically to either heal the harm that crime victims suffer, to rehabilitate people who have committed crime, or to meaningfully prevent crime in our communities. And so I've dedicated much of my life to working on those issues, to trying to find ways to make our criminal justice system more just. And that's the path that led me to be a San Francisco public defender and ultimately to run for and now serve proudly as San Francisco's district attorney.
And public defender, I understand with your background, but it has to be very conscious. This is really must have been a very conscious battle for you to want to come in through the door directly of law enforcement so that you could get the job to change the job. Is that part of your vision? Is that your motivation?
I absolutely want to help reinvent and reimagine the role of district attorneys, of prosecutors. And I want to be clear. When I went to law school, when I made the decision to become a public defender, prosecutors across the country, in virtually every single office, in the thousands of elected prosecutors' offices across this country, had been on the wrong side of mass incarceration. They've been contributing to mass incarceration. They've been resisting criminal justice reform. They've been advocating death penalty and life sentences and reducing investment in victim services and reducing investment in rehabilitation programs and reentry services. I didn't want to be part of that. It's why I became a public defender. I wanted to fight against mass incarceration. I wanted to help imagine and build pathways that help people transform their lives away from crime, not simply define them by their worst mistake and condemn them to lifetimes in cages. And I love my work as a public defender. But over the years, a national movement grew, a movement of people like me in many ways, running for and winning office as district attorneys in places like Baltimore, Maryland, and Boston, Massachusetts, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and Chicago, Illinois, and beyond. And I saw the tremendous influence that those elected district attorneys were able to have, not just in their jurisdictions, not just at saving lives and promoting safety in ways that are much broader and longer lasting than the narrow punitive prosecutor approach, but also on the national consciousness, on the conversation that we are having as a nation about how we respond to crime and how we engage in punishing those that commit it. And I realized that there was a unique opportunity, a unique moment. For the first time in my lifetime, there was a broad national consensus that the status quo approach to criminal justice was not working, that we could do better. And I knew and I believed that San Francisco could and should lead the way, that the Bay Area, with its progressive values and with its resources, should lead the way. And that's why I chose to run for district attorney, because of a commitment to do more for more people, to benefit more people, to make a bigger difference in public safety than I could have done in a lifetime of representing one person at a time as a public defender.
That was Chesa Boudin, District Attorney of San Francisco, being interviewed by Dennis Bernstein. Keep listening. We'll be back after a short break. Mitch Jeserich is the host of KPFA's Letters and Politics. He joined hosts Brian Edwards-Tiekert and Kat Brooks on KPFA's Upfront, where they spoke about new legislation working its way through Congress aimed at addressing police reform.
Both Senate and House are moving on police reform this week. Mitch, it seems like in a lot of places there actually is agreement between Democrats and Republicans. What's the key divide?
Well, it gets complicated, and a lot of it is in nuance, but it looks like there is some key divisions between House Democrats and Republican Senate, the Republican-controlled Senate. So let me just back up a moment and talk about what we anticipate happening this week. Last week, Republican Senator from South Carolina, Tim Scott, the sole African-American Republican senator, came out with his list of reforms. And they kind of go in the direction that Karen Bass in the House of Representatives had previously introduced, but not with the teeth that Karen Bass's proposals have. So in other words, Karen Bass's proposal from the House of Representatives would ban chokeholds. Tim Scott's measure would disincentivize using chokeholds. In other words, potentially, you could risk particular avenues of funding if you do not ban chokeholds yourself. It would also, for example, Karen Bass's measure would try to create a national database in order that cops would be a part of, so that if a police officer leaves a particular police force because of disciplinary issues or abuse of power issues, these kind of things, there'd be a national database to be able to track that. So to perhaps, at least at the very minimum, let other police departments know who they are about to hire if they choose to do so. Whereas Tim Scott's measure, it would just collect data on such things. Also, there's the issue around no-knock. Warrants.
Warrants.
Yeah, at the federal level, this is something that led to the death of Breonna Taylor in March, the nurse. Tim Scott's measure would just collect data over no-knock warrants, whereas Karen Bass's measure would ban no-knock warrants. And then the big item in the Karen Bass's measure is to do away with what's known as qualified immunity. In other words, this is qualified immunity. It means that police officers basically can't be taken to a civil courts by a plaintiff seeking damages for that officer violating their constitutional rights. Tim Scott's measure does not do that at all. Tim Scott has said he has already been told by the White House that that would be a poison bill if it made it into a final bill out of Congress that would still need the signature of the president in order to become law. So what's significant here, though, is also the process, because Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, today will be filing a cloture motion. And to invoke cloture means how you break a filibuster. And the reason he's having to do that on Tim Scott's proposals is because the Democratic leadership in the Senate says that Tim Scott's measure does not go far enough. So there is a division. They're not on the same page as what they are going to pass. And in order to break a filibuster, as you know, you need 60 of the 100 senators. You need a supermajority of senators to be able to break a filibuster so that you can move forward with debate. And, well, you could start the debate now, but so that you can go forward with a final vote on Tim Scott's measure. So that's where we are right now. And I think it brings up this age-old dynamic of, is what Tim Scott is offering in these proposals better than nothing, or are they so, and let's just say they are better than absolutely nothing, are they enough to, you know, perhaps squander the momentum that you have right now in trying to get something bigger, more substantial passed through? And so I think that's one argument people are going to be having in the Senate. And we'll see what, especially some of the more conservative Democrats do, because again, the Republicans only need 7 Democrats to get to that magical 60 number to break a filibuster. But let's just say they do that. Let's say they move forward and they approve Tim Scott's measures. You still have that measure of Karen Bass from the House of Representatives that's also anticipated to be approved later this week by the entire House. If you go by regular order, because you have 2 different measures, then what would happen is you would go to what's called a conference committee, where you have members of the House, members of the Senate. They get together and they work on these 2 bills and trying to turn it into a single bill. So there's the question of, well, do you want to stop the process right now where it is because you don't think Tim Scott's measure goes far enough, whereas maybe who knows what we end up getting out of a conference committee. So there's all these, you know, dynamics at play over what's happening this week, with not just the substance of what's in the bills, but also the process of how to get something to the president's desk.
Why do you think Republicans are so anti-qualified immunity? And the reason why I ask that is because, you know, across the country, rogue cops cost municipalities millions of dollars every single year. You would think it would actually make sense to lay the burden on law enforcement when they do harm, because maybe then they'd be incentivized to not do so much harm.
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably the wrong person to speak about at least why I think police officers are against undoing qualified immunity. And I do think Republicans are looking at a strategy for November, and maybe this would be their strategy anyways, of showing their support for police officers, that they're in support of law enforcement. I think this is something that they're hoping this moment that we're experiencing right now passes before the November, and there'll be a feeling of people tired of the fireworks, suddenly thinking they're in support of law enforcement again, needing law enforcement.
That was Mitch Jesserich speaking with Brian Edwards-Tiekert and Kat Brooks. Dr. Anthony Fauci is the director of the National Institute of Health's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and has been one of the most visible members of President Donald Trump's coronavirus task force. He went before the House Committee on Energy and Commerce to speak at a hearing about the Trump administration's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Committee Chair Frank Pallone Jr., Democratic representative for New Jersey, asked Dr. Fauci how the United States was currently faring against COVID-19 and pressed him on the president's recent remarks calling for a decrease in testing to lower official infection numbers.
Dr. Fauci, you are a trusted voice and have always been candid with us and the American public. Give us an unvarnished view of where we are at our fight against COVID-19 as quickly if you can.
Thank you very much for that question, Mr. Chairman. It really is a mixed bag. We have a very large country, very heterogeneous, major differences, for example, between the New York metropolitan area and Casper, Wyoming. If you look at how we've been hit badly. I mean, anybody who looks at the numbers, we've had now over 120,000 deaths and we've had 2.5 million infections. So it's a serious situation. In some respects, we've done very well. Right now, for example, the New York metropolitan area, which has been hit extraordinarily hard, has done very well in bringing the cases down and using the guidelines that we have very carefully put together in a stepwise fashion to try and carefully reopen their city and their state. However, in other areas of the country, we're now seeing a disturbing surge of infections that looks like it's a combination, but one of the things is an increase in community spread. And that's something that I'm really quite concerned about that. And you know that this has been something that's been in the press over the past couple of days, where we're going down from 30,000 to 25 to 20. And now we sort of stayed about flat. And now we're going up. A couple of days ago, there were 30,000 new infections. That's very troublesome to me. The way you address that, and I've said this over and over again, is you have to have the manpower, the system, the testing, to identify, isolate, and contact trace in an effective way so that when you see those increases, you can understand where they're coming from and you can do something about them. Right now, the next couple of weeks are going to be critical in our ability to address those surgings that we're seeing in Florida, in Texas, in Arizona, and in other states. They're not the only ones that are having a difficulty. Bottom line, Mr. Chairman, it's a mixed bag. Some good, and some now we have a problem with.
All right, now I'm going to have to ask about the president because you talked about testing and how important it is. And I, you know, Admiral Drawer and I know how important it is. At his rally over the weekend, the president said, and I quote, "When you do testing to that extent, you're going to find more people, you're going to find more cases. So I said to my people, slow the testing down, please," unquote. And this morning he said he meant this. So, Dr. Fauci, do you agree with that? Does it make sense that to safely open our economy, we should be limiting the number of tests rather than ensuring that anyone who needs a test can get one? And you don't have to mention the president. I did. But tell us about the testing. And
I, as a member of the task force and my colleagues on the task force, to my knowledge, I know for sure, but to my knowledge, none of us have ever been told to slow down on testing. That just is a fact. In fact, we will be doing more testing, as you've heard from Admiral Girard, not only testing to specifically identify people in the identify, isolate, and contact trace, but also much more surveillance if you want to get your arms around and understand exactly what's going on in community spread. So it's the opposite. We're going to be doing more testing, not less.
During questioning, Democratic Congressman Bobby Rush of Illinois noted that, statistically, African-American communities have been hit much harder by COVID than other communities, and asked Dr. Fauci what role race was playing in the pandemic.
when you're looking at the African-American community and the minority community in general as a demographic group, there are two elements that make it much more difficult for them and why they're suffering disproportionately. One is the risk of infection. Because of economic and other considerations, the jobs that the majority of them would find themselves in does not allow them to protect themselves by looking into a computer and doing telework. Most of them are essential on outside, having to mingle in a society in which the virus is circulating. So right at the get-go, they have a greater risk of getting infected. And then we know from a lot of experience now that the situation regarding whether or not you have serious consequences, hospitalizations, intubation, complications, and death, relate very strongly to the prevalence and incidence of underlying comorbid conditions, which are clearly disproportionately more expressed in the African-American population than in the rest of the population. And that particularly includes hypertension, diabetes, obesity, chronic lung disease, and kidney disease. So unfortunately, we have a situation where it's sort of a double whammy of a negative capability of them to respond through no fault of their own because of underlying conditions and the conditions in which they find themselves with.
When you consider racism itself as being one of the stresses that certainly impacts the African American community more in an extraordinary way than contributes to these comorbidities.
I think the question was what I consider institutional racism as contributing. No, I don't think there's.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Congressman. Well, I mean, obviously, the African-American community has suffered from racism for a very, very long period of time. And I cannot imagine that that has not contributed to the conditions that they find themselves in economically and otherwise. So the answer, Congressman, is yes.
That was Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Health, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, speaking before Congress on the Trump administration's response to COVID-19. This concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates that contributed to the production of this show. I'm Scott Baba. Thanks for listening.
This has been COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily broadcast by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates, produced by a group of committed men and women volunteers willing to make a difference. If you tuned in late, you can listen and download the show from our YouTube channel, Pacifica Foundation TV, or from the website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Tell a friend about it. It will be worth it.